Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Observatory, straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they are, have pretty good access to those people.
Actually, he subconsciously mocks that lineage, but he's
so that's happening.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every year, The New Yorker convenes a gathering, a festival of people who are pushing the boundaries in every field of endeavor, performers, artists, thinkers, chefs. And we're going to bring you three of those conversations today with the political journalist Naomi Klein, the chef and author Yotam Ottolenghi, and the comedian Hasan Minhaj. Minhaj is a veteran of The Daily Show, and when he hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner last year, he said no one wanted to do this, so of course it lands in the hands of an immigrant. Minhaj himself was born in the United States, but that's hardly the point. He's also in a generation of comedians that's changing the form. Someone starting to push past the need to be funny all the time and land a punchline on every observation. We see that trajectory in Minhaj's autobiographical show called Homecoming King on Netflix. He spoke about it with The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham, and we'll start with a clip from the special.
When 9/11 happened, I was a sophomore in high school. My dad sits everybody down at the dinner table. He's like, all right, Hassan, whatever you do, do not tell people you're Muslim. Do not talk about politics. I was like, all right, Dad, I'll just hide it. Cool. And this just rubs off. We're sitting there. Phone rings. I run to the phone, but my dad, he had a good first step, so he beats me to the phone. He's like, hello? I grab the second phone. Hello? And I hear a voice. Hey! Hey, you sand, where's Osama? He looks at me. You can hear me, right, you dune coon? Where's Osama? He's just like, yabbling. Hey, you can hear me, right? 263 Nogata Lane. That's where you live, right? I'm gonna f***ing kill you. Click. And my dad's looking at me. You ever see your parents and you see the mortality in them? Like, I'm looking at my dad and I see all 5'7" of him. And that's when I realized, no, I'm a dark book. I'm a scaredy cat. You know the way it is. We can speak two languages. Garkibate, barkibate. We can speak at home and outside. I should have said something. I didn't. We sit down, I hear foom, foom, foom outside. So me and Dad, we run outside and all the windows on the Camry are smashed in. And I look in the back and my backpack's open. I'm like, they stole my stuff. I reach and I pull out my backpack. But these pieces of glass get caught in my arm. And now all this blood is like gushing down the side of my arm. And I'm pissed. I'm just like mad. Man, this, man. Like, these kids, they know where we live. They're calling us. They're timing this in real time. So they're watching us. So I'm running up and down the cul-de-sac, looking in the trees, the bushes. I look back in the middle of the street. My dad's in the middle of the road, sweeping glass out of the road like he works at like a hate crime barbershop. Just like, oh man, we got customers, Lokyak Gang. We gotta clean this up. Zen, brown Mr. Miyagi, just like not saying a word. I run up to him like, Dad, why aren't you saying something? I'm not asking you now, say something. He looks at me and he goes, Hassan, ye cheeze to hote? Or ye cheeze hoenge? These things happen, and these things will continue to happen. That's the price we pay for being here. And that's when I was like, oh no, we really are from two different generations. Like, BMX bikes aside. Like, my dad's from that generation, like a lot of immigrants, where he feels like if you come to this country, you pay this thing like the American dream tax, right? Like, you're gonna endure some racism, and if it doesn't cost you your life, well, hey, you lucked out, pay it. There you go, Uncle Sam. But for me, like a lot of us, I was born here. So I actually have the audacity of equality. Like, I'm like, no, I'm an honors gov. I have it right here. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. All men are created equal.
One of my favorite lines from your special, which we did not see there, is that immigrants love secrets.
Oh, yeah.
And you just talk about how someone keeps something in for 30 years and then all of a sudden it comes out as this big revelation.
Right.
I wonder, like, with that as a backdrop, that being how you grew up, how did you make your way to this kind of work, which is so confessional and so personal? How did you, what made you want to do that?
You know, I started
as a sophomore in college. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the material early on was just like, oh, Facebook's weird, right? Like, you ever have people with weird status updates? It was real generic sort of stuff. And a lot of it was, you know, really just trying to do everything I can to contextualize mm-hmm. commonality with the audience of like, dating's hard, right? Or like, you know, and it's interesting. I had known all of those stories. I just didn't think it would have the right fit mm-hmm. in a two-drink minimum comedy club environment. You know what I mean? Like, be like, hey, what'd you guys do on 9/11? And like, sort of like, you guys endure a hate crime? And like, tip your waitstaff. Like, it wasn't the right format for it. And I actually sort of hit a wall with just traditional stand-up.
Yeah.
It really wasn't working for me as a medium. And there's a lot of really great comedians that I came up with that are great one-liner comedians, or they're really good at that, and it just wasn't working for me.
Yeah.
And I started pivoting more, and I started going to these things called the Moth Story Slams, and the creative director of the Moth, Catherine Burns, mm-hmm. had heard a couple of the stories that I was telling at the slams, and she's like, you should flesh this out into something more. And I started just sort of merging the two mm-hmm. of like, hey, I can tell stories, and there can be funny moments in it, and then get back into more serious stuff. And so I started shifting the show more into the theater space, and it naturally progressed there, you know?
So is that for you where, because those things come together, the personal, the political, and the comedic come together?
Yeah.
Does the joke start in one of those pockets for you? It's something that you're worried about, and then you're, how can I make this funny? Or is it something that's funny and you don't know why it's funny, so you have to figure out the serious part of it? Where's the genesis of this
stuff? Yeah, so for me, I think one of the things that like helped me a lot, and I was like, oh, I kind of think of things this way, was when I first started at The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking in and being like, okay, I just have to be funny. And so I would just throw out sort of jokes or quips or asides and be like, oh man, like Mitch McConnell looks like a turtle or whatever.
He does.
And he does, but
that's
but
still
I,
funny.
But I remember John being like, hey, like, what's your take on it? Mm-hmm. And your position, that shapes the entire act one.
Right.
So I'll give you an example. So like with the clip that we just saw with Homecoming King, the take is, the difference between me and my dad is my dad believes in this thing called the American Dream Tax, where, yeah, immigrants just go through shit, and if you don't die, well, you're lucky, so be grateful. And my take on it is like, no, like, equality is a right everyone should have. I'm born here. I have the audacity of equality.
Yeah.
And that then shapes the whole, what in that thing is like a 7 or 8 minute story, right? We do the same thing on the show. You have a clear sort of position or take, and then you build comedy around it.
So to go back a bit,
yeah.
What was your relationship to comedy specifically, but also pop culture generally when you were a kid? What were you watching? What kind of made you want to do this stuff?
I mean, believe it or not, I actually didn't really want to do stand-up. I was a big hip-hop head, sneakers, basketball, NBA. Like, that was my thing. I wanted to play in the NBA, and that sort of died in the seventh grade.
Yeah. Seventh grade is where it always happened.
Yeah, where you're just like, oh, man, like, I can't run and touch net. That's a problem. like this is going to be a huge problem to playing
just
in the
just waiting L. on that growth
and
spurt.
Then, and then you, like, sort of lie to yourself and be like, I could be like a Steve Nash. And you're like, yeah, but I'm just not good enough. and the world is telling me that. But I was actually really big in speech and debate. When I got to college, I was part of that whole Napster, Kazaa generation, right? Where people are like,
same.
Oh, do you want to see every episode of South Park ever?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like, that's a thing? Like, we can do that? How is that possible? Right?
Totally but, illegal,
yeah,
turns out.
And
not
yeah,
good. Yeah.
And that's how I first saw stand-up comedy. Like, I first saw it in its real sort of form. I used to think that, like, oh, it's the shitty part of Seinfeld. You know, at the beginning of Seinfeld?
and he's like, what's the deal?
Yeah, what laundry? And I'm like, no, get to the show. Like, get to the show. So when I went to my friend's apartment, he was like, oh, I'm watching stand-up. I'm like, ah, it's the worst. That's the worst part of Seinfeld. And he's like, no, watch this. And so this actually wasn't that long ago. It was Chris Rock's Never Scared. So it was a special that came out in 2004. I was a sophomore in college. And I remember seeing him talk about like the war in Iraq and like really stuff that was like really powerful. And I was like, oh, that's just funny speech and debate.
Right.
And that like clicked for me. I was like, oh, I should try to do something like that. Because when I was in high school and I would do speech and debate, whenever I would have to argue a position or point, if I made the judges laugh, I automatically saw like an increase in the amount of points that I would get, you know?
Right.
And so I was like, oh, that's like a really powerful tool to get people on your side.
Yeah. So it sounds like for you, maybe politics predated comedy.
Right.
Because like you talk about in the special, 9/11 was, of course, this seminal political moment for you and for your family.
Right.
But even while you were doing speech and debate, were you kind of a politics kid as well? Were you thinking about that stuff?
Yeah, I studied political science in college, but it was one of those things where I struggled with how do I contextualize the things I care about? Like, how do I communicate that effectively through an artistic medium? You know, with storytelling, you have to have an arc, and with comedy, there has to be points where people laugh. Yeah. So I was like, how do I do this? I didn't know how to communicate that without just sounding angry or telling a story that's just really sad, you know?
Let's watch another clip.
Okay.
And this is your set at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Okay.
It's from that.
Now, a lot of people think Steve Bannon is the reason Donald Trump dog whistles to racists. And that is just not true. Ask Steve Bannon. Is Steve Bannon here? I do not see Steve Bannon. I do not see Steve Bannon. Not see Steve Bannon. Not see Steve Bannon. Not see Steve Bannon.
So it's funny, right? Like, I would imagine that, like, one of the funniest things about that clip is the abject mortification of everybody
else.
And I just wonder, I'd love for you to talk about the process of building that set. You were asked not to roast the president because of his absence.
Right.
And just talk about what it took to craft a set that was so frontal about people that are in the most powerful positions possible in the country. I mean, how was that?
Yeah, so it was super, I mean, do you want me to start from like how I got the call and like?
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Yes, we
all right, so.
Second row,
so,
wants it.
Prashant, who's my head writer, he's here tonight. He was with me when we got the call. We were actually working on another sort of one-man show that I'm working on and developing. And I get a call from my agent. And he was like, hey, there's some interest in you hosting the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And I called Larry Wilmore, and Larry said something really powerful to me, too. He's like, are you kidding me? You're doing this. And he said, look, there's two ways to sort of protest and make a statement. There's people, you can throw rocks outside of the building, or you can do it within the building. And really, like, f*** some shit up, you know? And that Nazi Steve Bannon joke, that was candy. That was just like, let's have fun. You know, like that's a wordplay joke. But it's also, that happened pre-Charlottesville.
Right.
So I remember when we were workshopping it in New York, people were like, you can't say that. Don't call him that. Don't do that. This is way pre-Tiki. This is pre-Tiki. There's pre-Tiki and post-Tiki, right? This is pre-Tiki America. And the thing was, you know, the writers, everybody who worked on the speech, we really combed through every line because I knew that this is one of those things that would be documented in history. You know, they will transcribe your whole set. So I didn't want any single line to be misinterpreted or so I meant everything that I said, and I'm glad I said that joke, even though a lot of people were like, oh, you can't say that, or that's not fair to say. And, you know, post-Tiki, yeah, it's true.
It's true. So obviously that joke depends on an awful state of affairs.
Right.
Right? And
that's
I wonder.
So sad.
And I do wonder though, as needed as it is, whether you feel like in some way there's a sort of a perverse incentive for you where the weirder and worse things are, the more you have to talk about.
See, I don't like that.
I'm
this
just wondering,
that people are like, Trump must be great for your career. It's like, yeah, sure. More people are watching The Daily Show. But I would rather not have Nazis marching and I'll just write better jokes. You know what I mean? Like, we had great material even during the Obama administration.
There were jokes then.
Yeah, there's always been stuff to poke at.
Yeah.
So, like, that's just my position, you know, and that's right, my take right. on it, yeah.
And do you hold on to a hope that what you do, intermingled as it is with your voice and your take and your bias, do you have a hope that it will help make things better? Do you...
Yeah.
Are you thinking of it as a positive force in that way, or is it just what you're doing because it's what you like to do?
I mean, when I was at the Republican National Convention and I was there, I mean, it felt like I was at Comic-Con for crazy people. Like, it felt like being in a haunted house, but all the lights were on. I mean, when you see 17,000 people being like, lock her up, doing this, it was crazy. It was crazy. I felt when I was there, look, I can't maybe convince the guy who's wearing the Trump that bitch shirt. I can't convince that person to maybe see my side, right? I can be empathetic, I can be kind, but make no mistake, I probably will not reach that guy. The person that I do think I'm trying to reach is, and this is very real, a lot of my friends that I went to college with that I'm on like WhatsApp threads with, they're like, voting is dumb, being involved with politics is stupid, this has nothing to do with my life, I'm gonna watch the playoffs, you know?
Right.
Like, convincing that person, who I know is smart, who works at Google, or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is just like, I know that there's a chunk of people that are just sort of on the fence, you know? Mm-hmm. And I wanna reach them to be like, hey, maybe think about this issue from a place of empathy, and maybe it makes you do something, you know? Hopefully. Thank you.
That was comedian Hasan Minhaj with New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham at the New Yorker Festival in 2017. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and there's much more to come this hour, so stick around.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. After Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, was published in 2007, The New Yorker's Larissa McFarker wrote that Klein had become what Noam Chomsky was to an earlier generation on the left, the most visible and maybe the most influential thinker, someone who seems to tie it all together. In The Shock Doctrine, Klein argued that in capitalism, the most powerful people often take advantage of a crisis, whether natural or man-made, to force ever more stringent conditions on the vast majority of people. She's advanced that argument through a number of books, including her new one, The Battle for Paradise, which is about Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Naomi Klein spoke at the New Yorker Festival with staff writer Gia Tolentino a little less than a year into the Trump administration.
The concept behind the shock doctrine was that after a shock, this conservative wish list can move. People are primed to accept all of these ideas that would normally provoke resistance, but in the aftermath of a shock, don't. It goes both ways, right? There could be a shock doctrine on the left. We are in a time of crisis and shock in which we, I think, are looking for a big narrative. Mm-hmm. We're looking for that full, strong social justice, economic populism story. Yeah. I think there's
Trump, you know, when there is a Trump represents a crisis.
Right.
He's the embodiment of this crisis. I don't think he is the crisis exactly. He's a symptom of the crisis. When I was in England last week speaking at the Labour Party conference, I described him as being sort of analogous to the Fatberg, you know, because I wanted a local example. But I don't know if you know about the Fatberg, which
know
is
about
this.
The Fatberg.
So the Fatberg is this giant.
The thing in the subway.
In London sewers have this huge problem where everything sort of noxious has found it's all found at each other in the sewers of London. So we've got like cooking grease and baby wipes, and it's all just kind of congealed into this giant mass that is really hardened and they can't dislodge. And I think that that's very helpful in thinking about Trump. You know, it isn't just one thing. It's just like all the bad things, you know, and it's hard to dislodge, you know, so he is that crisis which, left to its own devices, will echo through geologic time. And so we have to react to this. And he can bring us together in that way because he's, you know, going after everybody and so much that we cherish. But we do need a common story. And, you know, I tried to give some examples of people trying to do that. The Movement for Black Lives, I think, has gone furthest in this country of mapping the vision for Black Lives, the affirmative, which is not just, you know, it is cops don't shoot black people in the streets, but it goes well beyond that into reparations, ending mass incarceration, ending police militarization. But I mean, more than that, I mean, it gets into tax code reform. I mean, it is the world after the end of white supremacy that they're mapping. And I think that's really been missing from movements because of the war on the imagination that is part of organizing in this rubble. But I think it's changing among young people who didn't get the ideological hard sell that my generation got, and so are able to imagine something beyond capitalism. And so if you look at the trajectory from, say, Occupy Wall Street in this city, where it was like, that was the no, like the very loud no, but when it came to what the yes was, what the alternative was, I think it was still in a moment of hesitancy, of like, well, of an sort of an unwillingness to say, this is actually what we want instead, this is the plan. But a lot of the young people who were part of that movement went on to work for Bernie Sanders, you know, in the UK are powering Jeremy Corbyn's campaign, you know, in Spain are part of Podemos, which also came out of that post-2008 financial crisis mass movement of that at first was just the no, and then kind of hit the limits of just saying no, and then started to articulate that, you know, the yes, and started to engage with electoral politics. And that's a big shift for my generation, because I think we really were casualties of that war on the imagination, where we could reject, but we kind of froze up, you know, when it came to imagining a world that was really different.
There's a sort of pattern recognition that you have been setting out for people to hang on to. And I wonder, do you think it's going to take hold, the idea, the recognition that Trump is, he's part of a pattern, you know, like he's not unexpected. He's not, and I think the stylistic shock really gets in the way often.
The stylistic shock in the political sphere.
Yeah.
But I mean, but not in the cultural sphere.
Not in the entertainment.
You know,
sphere.
He's mass entertainment, you know. He's combining various forms of American mass entertainment and applying them to politics. I think Trump is incredibly predictable, like so predictable that if you wrote a novel predicting that Trump would be president, you know, like a sci-fi book 10 years ago and handed it in, your editor would be like, this is boring, it's so predictable, like this is bad fiction, you know? But so the disbelief is, I can't believe that these things that were in our culture and so powerful in our culture actually went to their logical conclusion. So why didn't we think that if we are in that category? And that's worth interrogating. I mean, one of the roads that led to Trump, I believe, is this incredible worship of billionaires in the culture and the outsourcing of so many of the problems that we used to believe that it was our duty to solve democratically in the public sphere, in the public square. And this idea took hold. And it was not conservatives that advanced this idea. I would argue that it was more aggressively advanced on the liberal side of the spectrum, that, you know, Bill Gates is going to solve hunger in Africa. Richard Branson has got climate change covered with, you know, Michael Bloomberg. And, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has got the schools taken care of with Gates. You know, and why? Like, why? What qualifies them for this? Their incredible wealth. That's what qualifies them. That is not so different from Donald Trump standing before the American people and saying, sure, I have no qualifications, but I'm incredibly rich. That was what he said, right? So how dare we be surprised? And how dare we look down on people who fell for that? You know, when the Clinton Global Initiative in this city, you know, held up a parade of billionaires and outsourced the world's problems as if it was some grand telethon. And so... You know, I really think there has to be a reckoning mm-hmm. with the roads that led to Trump on the liberal side of the spectrum, because if there isn't, we are not going to get at these root causes. And, you know, I really fear that we are not going to present a genuine alternative that is captivating enough to win an election against him, which really, really matters.
Right. I think one of the harshest sort of truths to come out of this election was that, I mean, it turns out love doesn't trump hate, right? And you write in the book that, you know, love, you need something more than love. You need justice, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, and there is a part where you wrote, the choice that may at first seem radical, maybe even a little risky, may well be the more pragmatic one in this volatile area. And from the perspective of our warming planet, it's worth remembering that radical political and economic change is our only hope of avoiding radical change to our physical world. There's the risky thing, maybe the safest bet.
Or like what we have been trained to think of as safe, as pragmatic, is actually very risky if it doesn't work. Right? You know, I think Trump is very specific. I think there is a white lash going on. There is a response to, you know, this, he has to be understood, as Ta-Nehisi Coates has argued, you know, as a response to Obama. But I think there is also a risk of being too insular and too nationalist in analyzing Trump. I mean, this is a global phenomenon.
Right.
It is worth looking at the commonalities between the conditions that created Trump and that, you know, have created Brexit and you know, what's happening in France and Germany, India as well,
right.
Philippines as well.
You wrote, in an age of ever-widening income inequality, a significant cohort of our elites are walling themselves off, not just physically, but also psychologically, mentally detaching themselves from the collective fate of the rest of humanity. This secessionism from the human species, if only in their minds, liberates them not only to shrug off the urgent need for climate action, but also to devise ever more predatory ways to profit from current and future disasters. And you connect the dots here to the only way to justify this is through these theories of racial inequality. Mm-hmm. You can't justify walling yourself off unless you truly believe that you're superior. And racism is an incredible way to entrench that sense of deservingness, that you deserve that as long as you're safe, everyone's fine. And I wonder, and I mean, watching Puerto Rico, I mean, I did feel shocked watching Trump talk about it. You know, you always think you're unshockable now, but I mean, it was harrowing, and it was so blatant that, you know, this idea, you write, that the people being locked out of the global green zone deserve their fate in some way. And that was coming, it was breaching like sort of the semiotic surface of the way he talked about Puerto Rico. And I'm wondering kind of what you saw in this disaster and his response to it in reference to all this.
You know, in terms of this idea that they're going to be okay, I think we've spent a fair bit of time sort of parsing the various positions within the Trump administration, you know, the deniers, the outright deniers, versus Ivanka, who, you know, believes that climate change is real, or Rex Tillerson, you know, who also says it's real. To me, that's completely beside the point, because what they all agree on is that we shouldn't do anything about it. And certainly Rex Tillerson believes that, as former CEO of Exxon and somebody who worked there for 41 years. that, and he said this publicly, that yes, you know, when he first said that, yeah, admitted that climate change is real, he said humans can adapt. They'll move to where the food is, right? Humans have always adapted. And this, I think, ties in with, you do need those theories of racial superiority and white supremacy, theories of racial hierarchy. You know, they've always emerged when they are needed, right? They've always been strongest when they're most needed. And so the whole sort of scientific racism and all of that bogus science emerged as a rationale for slavery and colonial land theft. You had to have a story that told you why these groups of people did not deserve either their freedom or their land. And we are now in a moment where huge numbers of people are on the move, and I do believe that we all know that there are going to be many, many more people on the move. And so the need for those theories, the market for those theories, is increasing. We have to understand that. And the people who are being impacted first and worst from climate change are some of the people with the smallest carbon footprints on the planet, right? So we need the need for those theories that rationalize that fortressing, you know, becomes more urgent. And I think this is part of the reason why we're seeing, you know, so much more overt racism in North America and Europe right now. It's one of the reasons.
You know, like Exxon had studied climate change, or, you know, like Exxon had adjusted plans to accommodate climate change while denying it in public. And Pence, right, was part of this working group post-Katrina that submitted this big wish list, right, that included, the greatest one was like more drilling in the Arctic as sort of like a solution for the hurricane.
Yeah, so, I mean, when I wrote The Shock Doctrine, the Shock Doctrine begins and ends with Hurricane Katrina. And when I was in New Orleans, the city was still partially underwater, and I was reporting on how all of these lobbyists were descending on Baton Rouge with their wish list. There was a Republican congressman named Richard Baker who very famously said, "We couldn't clean out the public housing, but God did." And in fact, I mean, this was much of the public housing in New Orleans was undamaged by the hurricane because it was on higher ground, but this was very desirable real estate, and much of it was destroyed. So 2 weeks after the levees broke, there was a meeting at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, and it was chaired by the Republican Study Group. And they came up with a list of what they called free market solutions for Hurricane Katrina and high gas prices. They just bundled in gas prices. I mean, you know, they're bundlers. They like bundling. And so they came up with 32 recommendations, starting with, you know, don't reopen the public schools, give parents vouchers, charter schools, get rid of the public housing, create a tax-free free enterprise zone, get rid of Davis-Bacon, which is the law that requires paying the prevailing wage for federal contracts. All of this is reemerging now, post-Harvey and post-Irma. But what's important to know is that the chair of that meeting was Mike Pence. He was at that time head of the Republican Study Group.
All of these figures that you've been writing about for so long, they're all in the administration. It's wild.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think is there's a great piece in the Times by Eric Lipton and a team of reporters who've really been keeping track of what Scott Pruitt's been doing at the EPA and also what's going on in the Department of the Interior. And you know, there is this narrative out there that Trump is incompetent and he's not getting anything done, right? And certainly on the legislative front, they have been stymied, and thank goodness for that. But the power of being boring in the Trump era is really something, right? Because the Trump show is addictive. You know, even those of us who are appalled by it are to some degree addicted by it. And, you know, a guy like Scott Pruitt, I mean, he's so dull, right? There's no way he can compete in the Trump show. And it's perfect for him. I mean, and so here we are claiming they're not getting anything done. And in the Times today, I just have a list of all of the incredible feats that he has managed. Now, he hasn't pulled off everything, but he has pulled off a whole lot. I mean, basically, the governing theme is how can we make climate change worse? Like, how can we do more to accelerate climate change and also make sure that we're less prepared when it hits? So, you know, a tax on flood protection, getting rid of whatever measures have been in place to relocate people when they need to be relocated because their land has disappeared. The list is really, really quite harrowing and worth looking at. And I think we should be on guard of this narrative of incompetence, because I think when it comes to financial deregulation and what the Goldman Sachs team, which is quite large in the Trump administration, what they are quietly accomplishing and what Pruitt is quietly accomplishing is very, very significant. They are getting some court pushback, but they're also getting a hell of a lot done. And you know, they aren't discouraged. They're just coming at it from all ends.
You write that, you know, to admit that the climate crisis is real is to admit the end of the neoliberal project. And I think the same is true. I mean, to fully reckon with the Trump administration is arguably to reckon with the end of the neoliberal project. And I think that's a hard sell. I think that's, you know, that's
depends on your audience.
Well, right. But you know, I think it's an increasingly easy sell.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it's a very easy sell.
Mm-hmm.
But it requires, I mean, neoliberalism is seductive because it has its cold pleasures. You know, it has
mm-hmm.
these cold market pleasures. The fantasy of endless growth without consequences is seductive for a reason, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and I
mm-hmm.
think you write that to reject climate change, which is ultimately to reject the ideologies that produce Trump, is to relinquish this idea of, you write, ever-escalating creature comforts inside ever more isolated consumer cocoons. Yeah, never mind what the planet can take it or what actually leads to our deepest fulfillment. I mean, it's
right,
that's what's on the table, right? I mean, we
got. But I think most people aren't living that,
yeah,
aren't living right. that dream, right? And so, you know, I think I used to think that the primary task was sort of trying to get environmentalists to care about poverty and austerity and all of these economic justice issues and social justice issues, and lots of environmentalists do, but there are also still a lot of environmentalists that are, you know, just kind of focused on protecting green spaces and polar bears and things like that, and that's all fine. But I actually think it's an easier lift
yeah.
to be speaking to the growing numbers of people who understand that they are getting screwed by this system,
yeah.
right? And Trump certainly tapped into that. But, you know, I think part of the challenge that the Democrats face is that they have not been able to tap into that, right? And that, there was a campaign of Trump saying all is hell and Clinton responding, you know, all is well, but we need some tweaks, right? This is an angry moment. And this economy is not serving the vast majority of people in this country and around the world. And they're looking for big change. And this is, you know, why the Labor Manifesto was such a game changer in that election, because it was solutions on the scale of the crises we face, right? And there's a relief in that. After so much sort of like kind of people being presented with huge challenges and huge crises and then just being like, change your light bulbs, drive a Prius, you know, and also the willingness to confront power, right? I mean, Corbyn's slogan was for the many, not the few. And I sort of feel like if that slogan ever came to the United States, it would be sort of like for the many. And then just leave out that part about, like, actually we need to get the money from somewhere.
Right.
Right?
And there is money for taking, yeah.
And, you know, it is an economic populism that I think, like, that's where I believe the future of progressive politics lies.
You talk in the book about killing your inner Trump. Mm. And I wonder if you could talk about that somewhere.
Mm. That's the self-help section of the book. It's fairly short. it's just part of this idea of just trying to bridge this distancing that happens, right? I do think that he is this product of the culture we're all in, you know? And we're not all in the same parts of the culture, but we're all in it. you know, I think he is the worst of us. Not to say that we are all responsible for Trump. I don't think we're all responsible for Trump. But I do think that it's worth looking at, you know, our own fractured attention spans. And, you know, just this sort of like this idea of this president who just can't read, needs everything in a listicle, you know? You know, as we try to get beyond Trump, I think it is worth thinking about, you know, what part of us is just a little bit Trumpish. But, you know, maybe just the way, is there a way that we treat people on social media that's a little bit Trumpish and the sort of the, you know, set to nuclear that he's always got? or that waiting for the billionaire savior. You know, maybe Oprah will run, right? let's look within to find our inner Trump. Yeah. Slay your inner Trump.
And that part, especially, I thought, it's because so many of us function within systems that are constantly telling us that there are not enough resources for everyone to thrive. So we'd better elbow our way to the top, whatever the costs. And I think that the instinct, that kind of the fear instinct, that like the scarcity instinct is where that's where my inner Trump is.
Yeah. And, you know, and where I feel it, I mean, I feel it on the attention span, you know. We now have the first fully commercialized brand as, you know, a president, and he has a family of sub-brands, right? He breeds brands, right? And just like thinking about the way that logic, you know, how damaging it has proved to be, mm-hmm. It's challenged me in my political work and being, you know, building a new organization to be more conscious about, you know, our own brand and how, you know, I mean, as soon as you start an organization with a brand, you want to, you know, you want to protect it and you want people to use your brand, you know, and now it's like, let it go. It doesn't matter what they call it, you know, it's just the ideas. Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
That was Naomi Klein talking to Gia Tolentino from the New Yorker Festival in 2017. Klein's book, The Battle for Paradise, Puerto Rico Takes on the Disaster Capitalists, was just published in June. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a minute, a few cooking tips from Yotam Ottolenghi. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we're bringing you some highlights from the 2017 New Yorker Festival, and along with politics and humor and culture, you gotta have a little food.
The nice thing about this pavlova is really, it's like people when they imagine meringue, often they think it's something very sturdy, it's firm, but actually this one behaves just like a sponge, you roll it. And the way we achieve that is by baking it at quite a high temperature. So I don't know if many of you have made meringues before, but normally...
Yotam Ottolenghi's cooking isn't easily grasped. It's not from a single authentic source. He's an Israeli with Italian roots, and he's a connoisseur of various Middle Eastern cooking traditions. Ottolenghi made his name with a series of restaurants in London, and now, for an American, that may not all compute, but with half a dozen books, probably no one has done more than Yotam Ottolenghi to encourage an appreciation of Middle Eastern food that's way beyond falafel. The most recent book is Sweet, co-written with the baker Helen Goh.
Anything you like, really, because the beauty of it is that it is just an open canvas for people to play with. So I've got peaches and plums, I've got a little bit of vanilla in my cream and some icing sugar, and then I'm going to throw on some blackberries.
Before Yotam Ottolenghi was carved into the Mount Rushmore of celebrity chefs, he was on a different path altogether, philosophy. He was in a graduate program at Tel Aviv University that was so selective, students called it the Genius Program. He spoke with Jane Kramer at the 2017 New Yorker Festival, and Ottolenghi told her that as soon as he was done with grad school, he went off to train in the fine art of pastry.
When Yotam was finished with his dissertation in aesthetic and analytic philosophy, he took off for the Cordon Bleu and became a pastry chef. He said, I don't ever want to read another book, and I don't want to actually ever live in rooms full of books after being an academic, but I'll tell you something. This is his sixth book, Sweet, and we're about to have his seventh book very soon, and he is totally a sweet tooth kind of guy. I knew he had a sweet tooth when I was in London writing about him, and I got really hungry one night coming back in the car, and Yotam said, "I've got some candy in my glove compartment," and
it's
I opened the glove compartment, and the most appalling penny candy came out of it, and we both sat there eating it, and then we had a clandestine cigarette, and then we all went home, and it was thrilling. And so I want to talk about Yotam's, or I want him to talk about his journey from academia to pastry.
Yeah, like Jane said, I started in academia, and then I gave it all up when I was in my 20s. And when I finally did my master's dissertation, I sent a copy to my dad, and inside was a little note that I'm going to take a break and cook for the next year or so, and he was not impressed. And I have to say that one of my first work in the kitchen was actually in the pastry department, because often when you get a new chef coming into the kitchen, the head chef hands them over to the pastry chef because they just don't want to deal with them because they don't know anything. And then the pastry chef said to me, "Okay, well, you whip up my egg whites for the soufflés." So that's what I did for a few months. I just whipped up egg whites. I became this incredible expert in egg whites, which really came in handy over the years. And what I love about pastry recipes or cake recipes or baking recipes is they're very precise, and there's something very reassuring about this precision. If you're following a good recipe, then you're in good hands. Even with the food, I think you choose when you want to depart off and take your own way. And I always say, you know, you want to take your own way, make sure you do it when you've got it to a kind of a safe place. With cakes, it's really easy. You can't just cut the eggs by half.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
They're not going to rise, and you're going to get a pita bread instead of a sponge.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can play with the rest.
Yeah. But the safe place is there in all cooking, I think. But I know that when you and Helen worked on this book, that you have real arguments, and you think that has always in some way harked back to your academic background, where the tradition is dialogue, often very contestatory. But this is what I've watched with the partners in Yotam's enterprise, is that they have real arguments, and that's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, and these robust discussions are how we create, and it's always these partnerships, these collaborations, mm-hmm. that makes it really, really exciting. And with Helen, mm-hmm. It's been... So the way we work is that she... Helen is a real perfectionist. She's kind of very classically trained in the art of pastry, and she knows probably better than I do how things would react or interact in the baking process. And the discussions, like you say, they're very long, but they're quite geeky and intricate. And some people watch us and they go, and they kind of assume that we can't really be serious. There is a sense that it's either we're being kind of comical about it or funny about it, or this is just all an act, because we can really discuss whether it's 3/4 or 2/3 of a teaspoon of a spice that need to go into this cake, and really get into kind of a heated argument.
Yeah.
And in the end, we reach a compromise. But those arguments
are
great
productive
cakes.
And they make great friends, and they make great partners.
Yeah, they do.
But they make great cakes. I notice in your cheesecakes, you have some mascarpone. You have the ubiquitous cream cheese of all cheesecakes. You have some ricotta, which
we have a whole section about cheesecakes in the book, because we love cheesecakes, but also because, again, these were arguments. We couldn't decide which one to leave out, so we just included all of them. And we made a whole chapter about cheesecake. And actually, this feels like the right place for it, because New York is famous for its cheesecakes. But we have all sorts of cheesecakes. We have an Italian cheesecake, which is really very different. It has ricotta and hazelnuts and chocolate. And it almost feels almost like a like a shortcake. It's got a lot of body, although it's got cheese. And that's because ricotta has a higher water content than our other cream cheeses.
How different are cream cheeses from each other?
Cream cheeses...
That's a problem here.
Yeah, it is. The U.S. cream cheese is the bog standard one is better. We have a higher water content in our cream cheese in England, so that we had to change the recipes a little bit from when we translated the book from English English to American English, and cream cheese was one of those ingredients we had to play around with.
What are some of the dicier ingredients to translate from one country to another?
So it's really very complicated because the basic ingredients seem very innocuous. You know, what is flour? Flour is flour. But actually, American flour is different from British flour. So this is the first book we tested. We had all the recipes tested in America for this book. Normally, it's like a translation, but here inverted sugars are different. So we use you guys use corn syrup, and we use glucose syrup. They're very different from each other. That needed to be tested. There's a lot of things that are
also measurements.
The measurements are very different, and also I'm very evangelical.
And also here they're all different.
They're inaccurate because you don't know how much volume is not a good measurement of an ingredient. Yeah. You want to weight is much more reliable.
It's very difficult for us when our dog gains weight and then we discover that the cup measure we've been using is about a third the size.
I never thought about that consideration until now.
Yeah, well, actually, it's my primary consideration usually because he's heavier to drag.
Is he overweight?
Around. No, he's not overweight, but but some people say Hobbs has gotten a little porky this summer, eating in these, so I don't know. So I want you to talk about bringing the Mediterranean, bringing all of this, all these flavors, all these spices, all these incredible experiences to your food.
Yeah, I think I kind of, over the years, I went on a journey that included... So it started off from this corner of the Mediterranean where I grew up in Jerusalem, which was already pretty complex in terms of the flavors that were playing out, you know, because there were obviously the indigenous Palestinian cooking, and then all the food that has come with Jews from various parts of the world have come And I always say about Israeli food that it is really still in the making. You know, hasn't fossilized, it hasn't taken complete shape yet. And for me, that those flavors that I was exposed to and grew up on, both at home and in the streets, were really pushed me to go on a certain journey. And that journey took me, like you suggested, first kind of west into North Africa. Lots of Jews in Israel come from North Africa, from Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. And so I've had those kind of exposed to them early on. But then when I travel to those places, I've seen all sorts of interesting things going on.
But the flavors of good Israeli food now have a huge Sephardic influence.
Yes, it has really shifted.
And they're in your food, too.
It has really shifted. I mean, I think... Jewish food, I have this theory that they all arrived, and then it was like a Darwinian thing. It was survival of the fittest. You know, the best example of everything is the one is survive. So from the Ashkenazi food, it's the babkas and the cakes. The gefilte fish kind of was just kind of pushed to one side. And a friend of mine says, if you go to someone's house in Israel and you get gefilte fish, you know their grandmother is still alive.
But now tell me a little bit more about your next book, because your next book is called Simple, right?
Yeah.
And your next restaurant, when Yotam first decided he wanted to write a book, he was actually in that post-academic phase of, I don't want to see another book, another word, but he and Noam, I think it was, presented to a literary agent who said he should write a book. But before you do, you need a newspaper column. And there was a slot open at The Guardian, and it was the vegetarian slot. And this diehard vegetarian who had had the job for 50 or 60 years was retiring, and she was a kind of sacred cow, if that's all, God, that's the wrong thing to call a vegetarian. But she was rigorous in her purity. But so Yotam said, but, you know, I'm a carnivore. And they said, never mind, just do vegetable recipes. And the first, if I remember, recipe you wrote came with a little note under it saying, this would be really good with a grilled shoulder of a lamb cooked in the garden. And the letters came pouring in from the vegetarians.
Yeah, and it was called the new vegetarian. So the new vegetarian was a meat eater.
That's right.
And that was raised, there were a lot of angry people, and completely justifiable to be justifiably angry. And I think the trouble was that I got the job before I really internalized what it means like to be a vegetarian. And I learned the hard way. I got a lot of angry letters. It took them a long time to accept me as someone who writes good vegetarian recipes eats meat or fish once in a while.
So tell me, you're writing this new cookbook and you're now coming full circle with a vegetable restaurant, right?
Next year, we're going to open another restaurant in London. And my idea, I don't know if it's going to work or not. We'll see what the customers say. But to have the vegetables as the main courses and the meat as the side dishes. Yeah. The idea is to kind of turn things around and make it a slightly different hierarchy in the restaurant.
I want you to talk a little bit about simple, because it's another departure.
Yeah. So one of the things that my sister told me once, I'd love to cook one of your recipes, but I don't have the time. Really the way we've approached it is in the sense that I'm trying to understand people are looking for a way to cook ottolenghi that's not for a dinner party on a Friday night or a weekend where you can spend a lot of time. So the last year or so, we're trying to break what simple means for different people. And it's been the most amazing experience, only in the sense that I've really surprised myself that things tasted really good when the ingredients list had 10 ingredients and not 25, and it still had like all the kind of ottolenghi characteristics.
And flavor.
And instead of 6 herbs, there were only 2, and those are really short recipes. And I look at them and I say, how can it taste so good if it's so short? But it actually can.
Okay. Well, listen, you're hoarse probably now, but we have loved talking to you.
Thank you. Everybody
here has loved talking to you.
Jane Kramer, a staff writer since 1964, with Yotam Ottolenghi. His most recent book is called Sweet, and later this year, there's a book coming out called Ottolenghi Simple. And that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour today. I hope you enjoyed the show, and while you're killing time until next week, please follow us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.